All right. Well, here's where we're at, folks. And this is one of those weeks, we've had several of these in a row, not with the holidays and all, where the standards that are set for the regular Torah portions and which ones go on which Shabbat and so forth are a little bit different depending upon which calendar you keep. Now, that shouldn't be too surprising, but as you know, this is the time where we get pretty close to the end of the Torah. We still had the last Torah portion in the book of Devarim or Deuteronomy to go through. It has a great title. It's called Vezot Habraka, and basically what that means, and this is the blessing, where Moshe, the man of Elohim, blessed the children of Israel before his death. And, of course, this is basically chapters 33 to 34 in Devarim. And then, because in at least most of the Orthodox settings, this was the day that was called Simchat Torah after the week of the Feast of Sukkot, whereas some of us are looking at the sighted new moon and saying, okay, well, no, the sun just set. We literally just finished up the final day of Sukkot a few minutes ago here in the west in the Rocky Mountain time zone. And in any case, what that means is, well, Simchat Torah is today, the Sabbath day. But this is still the time where we do that great big turnaround, finish up the Torah portion, and then head on into Genesis 1. And we're not going to do all the traditional stuff, but I will do one thing anyway, and that is to kind of read right through the end of Devarim and on into Genesis, because I do like the symbolism there of that cycle that repeats. And that, of course, is one of the constants of Scripture, is this idea of cycles. You've heard me talk a lot of times about assume a solution of the form, the math of the universe. The Creator has literally made the universe so that we have cycles upon cycles, wheels within wheels, cycles that repeat, cycles that add up and that subtract out. We have phase and we have all kinds of things, whether we're talking electronics or the orbits of planets or of human civilization and the lives of mankind and, of course, the times and the seasons, too. So all of that stuff is just so, well, downright wonderful, I guess, especially at a time like this. It's great to reflect on and to go through that. So here we go. Vezot Habraka. This is the blessing. We've read this. Wherein Moshe, a man of Elohim, blessed the children of Israel before his death. And I won't go through all of it because another one of the laments that I have this time of year is that, and this is probably the single Torah portion that I would have done differently than the sages that set this up. I look every year at Genesis or Bereshit and the portion called Bereshit that runs from chapters 1 all the way through basically chapter 6. Of Bereshit, and I think, for crying out loud, who made that decision? That's too much for one week. We need to spend more time on all of that. Now, it's not that I'm ready to go to the 3-year cycle necessarily. I do think it's important to go through the cycle within the annual period because it gives us a chance to go through the Torah more and focus on different stuff in different years. But nevertheless, what I'm going to do with that in mind is perhaps a little bit short shrift here on Genesis, in chapters 33 and 34. I'll go through this a bit more briefly than I normally would so that we can spend a little bit more time on Bereshit, and I'll probably go into several different elements of that tomorrow in the longer Sabbath day teaching. Well, the blessing that Moshe gives begins this way. Yahuwah came from Sinai, rose from Seir. Unto them he shined forth on the Mount of Paran, came from the myriads set apart, holy, and at his right hand was a fiery, English says law, the Hebrew actually says Torah, unto them. Yea, he loves the peoples, all his holy ones, there in his hand. They sit down at his feet, receiving your words. And then it says, Moshe commanded us a Torah, an inheritance of, and I like this Hebrew word, the kahal, and actually it's kehilat, of Jacob. So we got the word is, masculine and feminine forms, but the congregation of Yaakov. And with that, what I'm going to do is just simply point out that there is, in fact, then a blessing that is given, and he goes through each of the 12 tribes, starting with Reuben, let Reuben live and not die, that his men become few, on to Judah and Levi, and all of the rest of the tribes. And again, I'll go through this fairly rapidly, but we have each of them named with sometimes a very brief blessing. In the case of Levi, for example, it's a bit longer when there. It's important that the Levites observe your word, keep your covenant, and teach Yaakov, your ordinances, and Israel, your Torah. Isn't that interesting? I do like, and I'll point that out, teach Yaakov your ordinances, and in this case, it's mishpatim, plural. It's actually mishpateka in this case. And Israel, your Torah. Now remember, Jacob and Israel, basically the same people, as I occasionally point out. Normally, we see a more earthy, more physical understanding when it's associated with the name Jacob than when he's renamed Israel. There's an aspect to it that's more spiritual. Isn't it kind of neat that in this case, it's Yaakov that gets your ordinances, and it's Israel that gets your whole teaching, your instruction? I do think that's kind of key. All right, when we get to the end of the chapter, after each of the tribes gets a mention here, we see that the eternal Elohim is a dwelling place. Israel dwells in safety, the fountain of Yaakov alone, land of corn and wine. Yea, as heavens drop down dew. Happy are you! Happy are you, O Israel! Who is happy like unto you? People saved by Yahuwah, the shield of your help, and that is the sword of your excellency. And your enemy shall dwindle away before you, and you shall tread upon their high places. Somehow or other, as we end the Torah cycle and think about the people getting ready to go into the land and the place where we are in the continuing cycle, that seems to me to be key. Tread upon their high places. Understand that He is our shield and His word, His Torah. Double-edged sword, we're told elsewhere. Important to remember. All right, chapter 34 describes Moshe's, literally, last act. He goes from the plains of Moab up onto Mount Nebo, top of Pisgah, over against Jericho, and as promised, Yahuwah shows him all the land. There's a description of all the places that he sees, Naphtali, Ephraim, Manasseh, the south, the plains, valley of Jericho, the palm tree city, as far as Zoar. And then Yahuwah says the following to him. This is the land which I swore unto Abraham, unto Yitzhak, and unto Yaakov, saying, I will give it unto your seed. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you will not go over there. And Moshe, the servant of Yahuwah, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of Yahuwah. And he was buried in the valley in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor. And no man knows where. No one knows of his sepulcher, it says, unto this day. He, Moshe, was 120 years old when he died. His eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. He was still filled with life. And the children of Israel wept for Moshe in the plains of Moab for 30 days. And eventually the days of Moab, of weeping for and mourning for Moshe and the field plains of Moab were ended. And then it says, Joshua, son of Nun, he was full of the spirit of wisdom, the Ruach, for Moshe had laid his hands upon him, and the children of Israel hearkened to him. They shemad, they obeyed him, listened and obeyed, as did Yahuwah command Moshe. And it says, and here comes literally the last three verses of the book, and there has not arisen a prophet in Israel like unto Moshe, whom Yahuwah knew face to face. Panim al panim. Now, there was a prophet like unto Moshe, as those of us that understand the coming of Yahushua, namesake, on that first occasion, as was prophesied and then fulfilled in the spring feast. But arguably, this is true. He wasn't exactly like Moshe, not a face-to-face kind of thing. There was a whole different aspect to his time on earth as the Torah made flesh. But back to the text here. There hasn't arisen a prophet like unto Moshe in Israel, whom Yahuwah knew face to face, and all the signs and wonders which Yahuwah sent him to do in Mitzrayim, to Pharaoh, to all of his servants, and to all his land, and in all the mighty hand, and in all the great terror which Moshe wrought in the sight of Israel. And we continue, Bereshit bara Elohim. Et Hashemayim Vayet Haaretz. We know the words. In the beginning, Elohim. Well, actually, let me read it a little bit more Hebraic understanding, not the King James that everybody's heard. In the beginning, Bereshit created ex nihilo, literally out of nothing, bara, Elohim, Hashemayim, the heavens, Vayet Ha'aretz, the earth. And the earth was, and I love this translation, I love the original in the Hebrew. Ve'ha'aretz was tohu v'bohu. Everybody heard that little wonderful alliteration in the Hebrew? Without form and void. But I think in the Hebrew, tohu v'bohu is actually something a little bit deeper than that. A little darker, if you will. Devastated, almost. Nothingness. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of Elohim hovered over the face of the waters and said, Elohim, let there be light. Or, and there was light. And Elohim saw the light, and it was good. And Elohim divided the light from the darkness. Now, I'm going to have to go through this fairly rapidly to get through six chapters, even, cursorily. But I want to make a couple of points as we talk about the creation understanding here. First, and I've already mentioned this idea of bara, the word is not used all that often in Scripture. This is the first usage, but it has to do with creating something. No, not just molding something like a potter molds clay. This is, there weren't nothing, and now there is. In other words, out of nothing, there was something. He literally, in this act of making, or bara, the conservation of mass energy was violated. He made nothing into something. And then we have in verse 4 this other concept that I really like. We're going to see it a number of times too in the rest of the process of laying things out, finishing the creative process. It's a process of division, of separation. And that's another one of those things that I think is fundamental to a kind of an engineering understanding of the universe. It's about differences. It's about splitting. It's about taking something and separating it from something else. So he divides the light from the darkness. And Elohim called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was, everybody knows that this is where at least one of the references to the day beginning, as it says here, with evening. He called the day, the light day, the darkness night, and there was evening, and there was morning, Yom Echad. Day one, or day the first. And Elohim said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and here it comes again, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And Elohim made the firmament and divided. So here's another act of division, dividing the waters which were under from the waters which are above this thing that's called the firmament. And he called the firmament heaven, Shemaim. There was evening, again, and there was morning, Yom Shana. Yom Shni, second day. All right, we'll pause there because I do see a question. Wouldn't Yeshua be a prophet like unto Moshe in that he taught Torah? Absolutely. So I think that when Moshe talks about a prophet like unto him, that is the reference. And you're right, it's one of many titles. And it's not only that he taught Torah, as Matthew 7 says, as one having authority, not like the scribes and the Pharisees, but he also, as we see, was literally, I do like this term, the Torah made flesh. In other words, he, as the author, ought to know. And so when he taught it and explained it, I know he wasn't adding to or subtracting from. He was literally fleshing it out. He was filling it with meaning. And that's one of the ways of looking at all that text. And that's why this first portion here in Bereshit is so interesting. And I think, I'd like to spend a lot more time on it than we have this evening. Because this creative act, there are so many things in here that are important to talk about. We'll hit a couple of the other things that I always hate to not hit as we go through it too. But we're seeing this process of division, dividing the waters from above from the waters from below. And he said, then let the dry land appear. And it was so. And he called the dry land Eretz, earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And Elohim saw that it was Kitov, was good. Over and over again, we're going to see that with one little exception, which we'll get to towards the end here. And said Elohim, let the earth put forth grass, herb yielding seed, fruit trees bearing fruit after its kind, wherein is the seed thereof upon the earth. And that too was so. Now, quick observation here, especially nowadays, given that we have so much crap, and that's the politest term I can use, that's being sold by the Monsatans of the world as food or seed, and it's not. The Terminator gene, right? You've heard about this? The soybeans and the so-called corn, the Franken-soy and the Franken-corn and all these other poison crops that have the Terminator gene. The seed will bring forth something. The something probably isn't good for you to eat. It may destroy your immune system. Certainly has got all kinds of other problems that aren't being acknowledged. But the key is the following. It don't reproduce according to its kind. It's not alive in that sense. It's not food, but it's not even seed. And I think that's so important as we go through this. Let me read this again. And Elohim said, let the earth bring forth grass, herb yielding seed, and fruit tree bearing fruit after its kind, and the seed thereof upon Haaretz. And it was so. Now, as we go through these next few creative days, you're going to see that this idea of bearing seed and bringing forth seed according to its kind isn't limited just to herbs and grass and trees. It's also going to apply to animals. And it seems to somehow or other be really, really key and important. And, of course, that, too, is ketov. It's part of the reason it's good. It's the earth, he says, brought forth grass, herb yielding seed after its kind, tree bearing fruit, wherein the seed is thereof after its kind. And Elohim saw that it was ketov, good. And there was evening and a morning, Yom Shloshi. Shlishi. Sorry, there we go. Get it right. Got to get the right emphasis and vowel pointers. The third day. And said Elohim, now let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide, there's that word again, division, to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. So we have lights that are being placed for the purposes of not just dividing the day from the night, but also as oat, signs, and seasons, and to mark the cycles, the repeating cycles. Let them be for lights in the firmament of the Hashemayim to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And he made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And he set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule over Mishol, to rule over the day and over the night. And here's this word again, to divide the light from the darkness. And Elohim saw ki tov. It was tov, good. And there was evening and morning, day four. And said Elohim, now let the waters swarm with lots of living creatures. Let fowl birds fly above the earth in the open firmament of Hashemayim, the heaven. And it's actually plural, the heavens. And Elohim created the great sea monsters, every living creature that creeps, things that literally swarmed within the waters after its kind, and every winged fowl after its kind. And Elohim saw that it too, ki tov, was tov, it was good. And he blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply. First commandment in Scripture. And it's not to man, although he repeats this to man. This commandment is to the animals and the birds and the fish. Be fruitful and multiply. Well, this is actually before the animals, the cattle of the earth anyway. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the waters and the seas, and let fowl multiply in the earth. Okay, so question from Deb about the herbs were given to us for medicine. There is a reference. I'll have to find it. Laughter is a medicine, too. I remember that one from Proverbs. Okay, can't find one except in Revelation about during the millennium and the tree there. I think there's another reference as well. But as off the top of my head, without looking it up, I'm not sure either. And the one that we read where it's for food. So let me think about it, Deb, and if I can remember it, I'll put it in the, we'll put it in the basket and try to come back to it. Next, he says, let the earth bring forth the living creature after its kind. Cattle, creeping things, beasts of the earth after its kind, and that too was so. He made the beast of the earth after its kind, cattle after their kind, every living thing that creeps upon the ground after its kind, and that too, ki tov, it was good. And said Elohim, now, let us make man in our image after our likeness. A lot of folks get hung up on this. All of this is the plural form. Certainly let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them, this too is plural, by the way, the word there for man, of course, and a lot of folks know this, there is Adam. Adam is literally the word that means man. And interestingly, Adama is the term that means dirt or earth or ground. But it's man that's being created. Ha Adam, the man, is a specific instance. This particular man, who also is given that as his individual name. But at this point, man is being made. He's going to be given dominion over the fish of the sea, fowl of the air, over the cattle, over all of the earth, and over every living thing that creeps upon the earth. And it says here, and created Elohim et ha-Adam. Okay, let's pause. Let's do quick Hebrew. Ve-yivra. There's that same root, bara. He created man in his own image, et ha-Adam. What gets created? Et, that's the pointer to the thing that he is creating, ha-Adam, the man, in his own image. In the image of Elohim created he him. Male and female did he bara otem. Did he make them? And in these couple of verses, we have all kinds of literally fundamental concepts about the creation. In his image, whatever that means, and of course, probably most of us have heard lots of speculation, concepts, different ways that that could be read and interpreted. Bottom line, though, in whatever way it is, it was very important that he created man in his image. In what respect? We're not 100% sure, but certainly it's in the most important respects. And furthermore, male and female, he created them. Well, that's not what you're going to hear in the public indoctrination centers nowadays, or from Holy Hollywood, or any of those other places that are set apart for just cause, from all of those who understand that they're pushing a lie as opposed to the truth that we find right here. Elohim, it says, blessed them. And he said unto them, first commandment to Ha-Adam, or to the plural, mankind, be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that creeps upon the earth. And then he says this, behold, I have given you every herb yielding seed. He thinks that the seed thing is important, I guess, propagating into its own kind. Everything yielding seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of the tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for food. And to every beast of the air, every fowl of the air, to everything that creeps upon the earth, wherein there is a living soul, nephesh is the word there, every green herb I have given for food. And it was so. Now pause on this one. When I read this, I think about the way I remembered having first had this explained, and it still resonates to me with a whole lot of truth. This was at one point clear. Perhaps now, given what's happened and what we're going to see in this Torah portion, it is less so. But at the time of his creation, first thing man is told, be fruitful and multiply. And the second thing, basically, is I have given you dominion. It's almost like what he's saying here is you have the title deed to the whole, well, ha'olam. Certainly ha'aretz and everything on it and everything in the seas. The title deed, if you will, to planet Earth is given to ha'adam. Does he keep it? What does he do with it? Well, we'll come back to that question. But verse 31, last verse in chapter 1, summarizes it, and we'll see one small, well, actually one big difference here. And it says, Elohim saw everything that he had made, and behold, it wasn't just ki tov, it was tov meod. Everybody knows this one, right? Very good. It was good, very. Tov meod. And there was evening, and there was morning. Evening and morning, yep. Day 6. And the next chapter says, and by the way, the chapter markings, of course, as you probably are aware, aren't in the Hebrew Torah, but it is a reasonable place to put a break if you're going to put one in there so we can find our place. And Hashemayim and Haaretz. Hashemayim veHaaretz were finished. Kol, all of the hosts of them. All done. So on the seventh day, finished Elohim all the work which he had made, and he rested on that seventh day from all the work which he had made, and he blessed day 7 and hallowed it, set it apart. Because in that day he rested from all the work which he in creating had made. And there's a root word there that actually kind of has a similarity to the root word for Shabbat. Matter of fact, it is Shabbat. Appears in verse 3. These then are the generations, Toldot. Remember, we have a Torah portion with that name. And by the way, there's also in here one of the little yods and tittles, this small hey in that word. These are the generations of heaven and of Haaretz when they were created in the day that Yahuwah Elohim made earth and heaven. And this, verse 4, is the first place set apart where we see the Tetragrammaton in the scriptures. First occurrence of Yahuwah, Yod Hey Vav Hey, is there in verse 4. These are the generations of Hashemayim and Haaretz when they were created. And they there, this is that word, created, that the same root word, bara. It does not appear too often elsewhere, but it certainly appears in the creation story, doesn't it? And it's got the small hey in there to make that clear. In the day that Elohim, Yod Hey Vav Hey, made Aretz ve-Shemayim. And it says here in the next verse, no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, no herb of the field had yet sprung up, for Yahuwah had not caused it to rain upon the earth. There wasn't a man to till the ground. But there went up a mist from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground. And then, and what we're getting here, according to most understandings, is kind of a repetition, a second creation story. Or are we? I'll admit. Well, I tell you, as a coder, this may or may not make any sense to folks, but if you use most computer languages, what you'll find is that in so many places, before you use a variable or before you actually write a program, the first part of most programming languages has a bunch of what are called declarations. Okay, let's define some things. Let's set aside some storage space for variables. Let's define the terms. It's a setup. And you'll see in some programming languages, they'll even talk about the general and the specific. In other words, we're going to make this thing we're going to call man. Okay? Concept. Here's a man. Man is going to be created in the image of Elohim, and he's going to have aspects like, well, male and female. He created him. He set aside, if you will, the plan, the template for man. And now what we're going to see is the specific instance. So literally, in a programming language, and this is so common that it's almost hard to explain, but if you understand how the computer system works, and you think, well, maybe there's some elements of the creation that apply here, it becomes more clear. So we set aside the space in our memory. We say, here's where these variables are going to be stored. Now we're going to create a specific instance. We're going to call the variable X, and we're going to use it to store this. Or we're going to call the first instance of this generic man, Ha Adam, the specific instance of the first one. And now we're going to describe what happens with Ha Adam, the man. And it does in verse 7. I don't like the English translation here because it says, in at least the King James-ish version I'm looking at, it says, then the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground. Nope, that's not what it says. It says, then, of course, Yahuwah. Elohim formed, or actually it says formed Yahuwah Elohim et, right? What's he going to form? Et points to what it is, Ha Adam. Do you see the difference in this context? Now he forms a specific man, the man, Ha Adam, the one that's going to have that name, of the dust of the ground. Notice too, the first time we talked about his creation, it was bara. It was this ex nihilo. Out of nothing, he is in his, well, maybe in his mind, he is forming, he's making the parameters. In his image, he is going to create from nothing the concept of man. In a generic sense, male and female, he's going to create them and so forth. But here we have the specific instance. And he is formed not, well, kind of like in the computer again. We have the space allocator, but now there's a specific instance. This one, physically formed from the dust of the ground. And I've already mentioned this. Adama. Ha Adama. You might recognize, too, there's a reference to red in there. We see that with Edom. Similar word. So we have the specific instance, Ha-Adam, the man, formed from the dust of the ground. Ha-Adama. And then, he wasn't done yet. Into his nostrils, he breathed the breath of life. And we know breath is another one of these words that has to do with wind, and there's an association that we see throughout Scripture with the Ruach, with the wind. Nashamat Chaim. Okay, nefesh, life. And the man became a living la nefesh, soul. The root words here in the Hebrew, well, they have a lot more to do with each other. We think these are separate concepts, but this concept of soul and life are literally the same word. Somehow or other, when it comes time to think about and you know, pray about, look at the specifics and say, what is it about this creation story that each time we go through it, we see a little something that maybe we hadn't noticed before? I would focus on some of these verses, like chapter 2, verse 7. Next one says, then planted Elohim, and it's Yahuwah again. We're going to see the word Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh a number of times after that first use. He planted a garden to the east in Eden, Gan Eden, the garden in Eden. And there he put this man, Ha-Adam, that he had formed. It's funny that we don't see his name translated yet at all in the English. And yet, over and over again, in the Hebrew, he is Ha-Adam, the man. Out of the ground made Yahuwah, same ground that Adam was created from. Yahuwah Eloheka, grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. Are we seeing something similar here with trees? That we have the template first and the creative template. Now remember, they hadn't been watered yet. It told us that. Now things are coming up from the ground via the process of seed becoming trees and seed becoming herbs. He made these things grow, all these trees, pleasant to the sight, good for food. The tree of life, also there in the middle of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Tov v'ra. Literally, tov v'ra and ra, evil, or bad. And a river went out of Eden to water the garden. From there it was parted. It became four different heads, tells us the name. First one was Pishon. It encompasses the land called Havilah. There's gold there. Then the gold of that land is good, tells us. And there's bdellium and onyx. The second river, Gihon, it encompasses the land of Cush. Now, one thing we do seem to know about Cush is that, Cush is now generally considered to be Ethiopia and that part of Africa south of Mitzrayim. So is Gihon the River Nile? Would seem to be, but maybe there's been some change in direction because we know other things are going to happen at the time of Peleg and the division. All right. There's a third river. Its name is the Tigris. Goes east out of Ashur. The fourth river is the Euphrates. And Elohim took this man. And by the way, it's Yahuwah Elohim. Took the man And he put him there in the garden, Gan Eden, to dress it and to keep it. So he has a job. He's going to be in the garden, and he's going to take care of it. And Yahuwah Elohim commanded the man. This is this first use of that word, of the command, zavah, and it's in the peel sense, which means that's kind of like, I like to think of it as the emphatic conjugation. This is something important, in other words. And you know what he's going to say. Second command, after be fruitful and multiply. Oh, but before the specific instance was created. So here you go. It's a command that existed, pre-existed Adam, but it was, well, it pre-existed Ha-Adam, but not necessarily the form of Adam. You with me? You see the difficulty here? But he tells him the following. Now, Adam is going to hear this, the specific instance, going to hear this one. Of every tree in the garden, you can eat freely, have your fill. But this one, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat of it. Notice we just had this reference to the tree of life. He doesn't say you can't eat from that one. I always wondered, why doesn't he? Would have made sense. Anyway, he picked the wrong tree, as it turns out. We know the story. Tree of the knowledge of good and evil, unequivocally, you are not to eat of it. And it's important, I think, that we see specifically what this says, because it's going to be important to what follows. Doesn't say here, don't touch it, does it? Says, don't eat of it. In the day that you eat of it, surely you will die. In that day. And Yahuwah Elohim then says, it's not good that man should be alone. I will make for him etzer kenegdo. I love that term. This is the first use of that one. And it gets translated as help meet, or a helper that is meet, that is good, that is of value to him. And there is also a there's a couple things about the conjugation and the way this term is used in the Hebrew that the sages that know more about the language than I do will point out. One of which is this help meet for him, that the word there is the ke sound, ke negdo. Help meet ke negdo, for him. Also has a an implication, I guess you'd say, of that there's an opposite aspect to it. What he is not good at, this helper is, and vice versa. They're a complementary pair. And I think that's important. And we've already seen, again, male and female, he created them. Before this act, he already had the template in mind. You could almost say he knew the end from the beginning, right? Out of the ground of and out of the ground formed Yahuwah Elohim every beast of the field, every fowl of the air. He brought them unto the man. Wait a minute. Can we see the pattern? It keeps coming back. We've seen the first creation story, and now we're again seeing after the formation of the template that he is creating these beasts, fowl of the air, beast of the field, out of the ground also. He brings them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man calls every living creature, that was its name. Shemo. That was its name. It wasn't a name. It didn't have a name until Ha-Adam, the man, gave it one. And we'll probably come back to some aspects of this tomorrow, too. But one of the things that I think is key as we look at the story and we see these things playing out and ask, what are the implications? What are the things Scripture is showing us here? This is called naming authority. Adam has it. He has already been given a dominion. And we're seeing another aspect of this dominion in that he takes these things. They didn't have a name. To name something is kind of helpful in understanding what it is. It defines something. So Adam literally names them. He has the authority to do this, given to him by the Creator who has given him that dominion. And a man, it says, Ha-Adam, gave names to all the cattle, to all of the fowl of the air, every beast of the field, but maybe one of the aspects of what is being shown to Adam here is that, there isn't one of these that is a suitable helper for you, complementary to you, in part opposite, in front of. And here is the first place, at least in the English Bible, that it says, but for Adam. Okay, we've seen his name used. And literally, there's no difference in the Hebrew. It's just Ha-Adam again. Well, there wasn't a suitable Etzer Kenegdo for him. And Yahuwah then caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man. He slept one of his sides. I think that's a better rendering than ribs. He took from him. Side is kind of interesting too, isn't it, right? Almost implies a half, a part. If it's a complementary part, he takes one half. All right, we got the complementary other side. He made from him, and here comes the name that is going to be given to the one from him, Isha. And he brought her unto the man. The man said, this is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, Isha, because she was taken out of man. Therefore, we get a conclusion here, end of chapter 2. Therefore, it says, a man shall leave his father and his mother, and he shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be flesh echad, of unity. And they were both naked. What does that mean? Arumiyah, arumim. Man and his wife, but they were not ashamed. Another way to translate this, they were not disconcerted by that. They weren't disappointed that they were somehow naked. They weren't confounded by their state of clothlessness. Okay, you know what, folks? We're now just getting to the part that I think is one of the most key elements, and I'll go through this story very rapidly because I'm sure we'll want to touch on this again tomorrow. I cannot read through the story of Genesis and literally where the plot thickens for the entire rest of the book and without thinking again, why is it that they don't have an entire portion in the Torah on just chapter 3 or maybe chapters 3 and 4? Okay, we got this creature that's introduced, one of these things of the land. It's called Ha-Nachash, and it says here it was Arom, subtle. Okay, I don't like the word subtle in the English. The Nachash, it gets translated as serpent, but I'm not convinced this is a serpent that looks like what we're used to. Maybe more dragon-like, who knows? Maybe it was really attractive. Whatever it was crafty, it was shrewd, it was Arom, and you know what? That word just gets used in this one case. But whatever this word means, he was more of that than any beast of the field which Yahuwah Eloheka had made, Elohim. And then he said to this person, Ha'isha, the woman, hey, has Elohim said you can't eat of any tree of the garden? He does not make a statement. He does not come out with the first big lie. He asks a question. Now, this one has come up. I had a question online. Somebody that's here even basically says, oh, well, when you talk about the first lies in Scripture, the first big two lies, you're leaving out the one here in verse 2. And I will contend that Isha here is not lying so much as she is basically, is she repeating what she's heard? How did she get this word? We don't know. We're not told. But she does seem to be adding to it. The popular term that you'll hear in terms of the oral tradition, the thing that the rabbis do, they're building a fence around the Torah. We don't want you to get too close to the edge. We're going to build a fence around it so that you don't accidentally violate it. So did Adam decide to make this addition too, or does the woman come up with it on her own? Again, I don't contend that it's a lie, but it certainly is an addition. She gets it right, and then she should have quit when she was ahead. She says correctly, of all the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, but the fruit of that one tree which is in the middle of the garden, Elohim has said, you shall not eat of it. Again, if she just put a period there, she's fine. But we got this line, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. That is clearly not in the original commandment. It does look like an addition. Who done it? Right? We don't know. Did she make it up? Did Adam make it up thinking, if I just keep her from touching it, that'll give an additional layer of safety? As it turns out, it doesn't, does it? And I like to say, here was a mistake that Eve made. This little addition is a mistake, and it is a mistake that HaNakash is going to basically use to drive a truck through, we would say nowadays. He, you know, you can just see him saying, aha, there we go. There's my in. And the Nakash says to the woman, no, no, you will not surely die. Lo mot. No, you won't die. Now, wait a minute. That is a lie. He is contradicting explicitly what is said. Now, he doesn't basically do it quite in the, you know, it's the 80-20. It's a little bit of a twisting here. Not surely die. The implication is you won't die immediately. He didn't say you would die immediately, remember? He said on the day. How long is the day? Who knows? Could be, well, a long time. Could be the better part of 1,000 years. But whatever it is, he says, no, you won't surely die, which is clearly lie number one. For Elohim knows that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and this sounds like lie number two to me. You shall be as God, as Elohim, knowing tov vara, good and evil, or good and bad. Then the woman saw. Now she saw with her eyes, lust of the eye, pride of life. She saw that the tree was good for food. Wait a minute. Is it food? Right? I was talking about these herbs, these things yielding seed, the Monsatan frankincorn. Is it food? I would contend it's not food. Pig is not food. People would say, well, I see with my eye, pig is good for food. Similar concept, I will suggest. Okay, the woman saw the tree was good for food. It was a delight to the eyes. It was desirable to make one wise. So she took of one of these, took of the fruit. She picked it up. Now let's parse this real carefully just for a second. She touched the fruit. She had to touch it to take it, to lachach, the fruit. And then she ate. And then it's, now how much time passes? We don't know. Here's one of those places where I'll just kind of, well, we'll say plant the seed. She took of the fruit, she ate, and then she gave also to her husband, who at some point was with her. Was he with her this whole time? Was he just standing there silent like a dumb ox? I don't know. I have trouble believing that part personally. Your mileage may vary, okay? I actually tend to picture maybe some time elapsed, whether it was seconds or minutes or hours. We don't know. But one thing is clear. The sequence is clear. She touched it, didn't die. Then she ate it, and then she gave some to her husband, and then he ate. Now, wait a minute. How long did all this take? Did Adam watch? Was he watching? I don't know. Did he say, oh, she's chewing it, she's swallowing it, she's not dying? Whatever happened, notice the sequence. It wasn't until Adam, the man, eats that the next verse says, ve, then, and. The eyes of both of them were opened. So this, I will contend, is a really significant point. And it's fundamental and it's usually overlooked. Okay? It was Adam that was given dominion. It was Adam that has naming authority. It was Adam that was created first. It was Adam that at least was responsible, since he was there and heard the original commandment, and it was in the peel conjugation, you ain't gonna eat this one tree. He had all of that responsibility. And when he failed, not when she first ate, but when he failed, were the eyes of both of them opened. So I will conclude from that, that the sequence is clear and that the implications seem pretty clear. Adam had authority over her, and when he failed, and we see this in Numbers 30, we see it with vows, when he failed, then the eyes of both were opened. This is why I will contend Adam rightfully gets the blame. He was responsible. He blew it. He bears her guilt. Right? Smack out of Numbers 32. The principle, though, is right here in Genesis 3, 6 and 7. All right, now they hear the voice of Yahuwah Elohim. He's walking in the garden in the cool of the morning, and the man and his wife hid themselves. It says cool of the day. I read that as morning, but maybe I should be more careful. The man and his wife hid themselves because they somehow or other had now decided they were naked. Remember, they sewed themselves some fig leaves. So they hid themselves from Yahuwah. He asks the usual Socratic question. Where are you? You don't think he knows? Okay. He's somehow or other, he's got a lesson to teach. Well, says Ha Adam, I heard your voice out here in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked. I hid myself. Wait a minute. Just who was it told you you were naked? Have you eaten of that tree that I commanded you not to? As if he didn't know. Well, says the man, that woman, oh yes, her fault. She, the one you gave to me, remember? She gave me of the fruit of the tree and I ate. It's not a lie. It is a little bit of a blame shift. It's an excuse. It's a cop-out. Then Yahuwah says to the woman, Le Isha, what have you done? Well, she says, not done with the blame game yet, that Nakash, that's his fault. He beguiled me, and I ate. And here we get consequences. Another very key understanding. Yahuwah then says unto first Nakash, Ha Nakash, because you've done this. You, notice who is cursed or what is cursed. Adam is not cursed. The ground, we're going to find out, is cursed for his sake. But in this case, Ha Nakash is in fact cursed. You are cursed from among all cattle, from among all the beasts of the field. On your belly you will go, and in the dust you will eat all the days of your life. Did his legs disappear at this point? Interestingly, there actually are some snakes that herpetologists, those who study snakes, will tell you about. I've seen them, you know, in a zoo or somewhere. As a kid, I was really interested in snakes that have vestigial legs. You see little tiny legs hanging on the edge of these snakes, crawling around on their belly. Interesting. Does seem to at least go along with the concept here that's being outlined. I picture the legs kind of just shriveling up and eventually, you know, falling off. But in any case, one way or the other, you're cursed, O Nakash. On your belly you go, eating dust. And furthermore, I'm going to put enmity between you and the woman. And here comes the seed reference again, between your seed and her seed. They shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise their heel. Right, he's done with Nakash, on to Al-Ha-Isha. He says, I will multiply your pain and your travail. In pain, it will be that you will bring forth children. And your teshuka, your desire, will be unto your husband, and he shall reign over you. Now, already he has authority. But it seems like in this case, this word reign is a little bit more, explicit. Have dominion. Finally, he says to Ha Adam, because you listened, you hearkened, right? You know the word in the Hebrew, shema, shamard. Because you shamard, hearkened, and I know I'm butchering the Hebrew there, but you get the point, right? It's the sheresh, the root word that means hear and obey. Or hearken in the old King James English, and I like that word because hearkened does mean hear and obey. You hearkened to the voice of your wife. You were supposed to be an authority, dude. You blew it. You've eaten of that tree of which I commanded you, saying, hey, remember, you shall not eat of it. And so, as a result, you're not cursed. Listen carefully. Cursed now is the ground. Where did all the beasts of the field come from? Where did Adam come from? Where do the things that grow up, bearing seed after their own kind, the herbs, the grass, the trees, they all come from Ha Adamah, the ground. And it's the ground, not Adam, but Ha Adamah, that is cursed for your sake. You will toil, and in toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. And not only that, it's going to get ugly. It's going to bring forth thorns and thistles to you. You'll eat the herb of the field, but in the sweat of your face will you get your bread. Till you return unto the ground, because out of it you were taken. Dust you are, and to dust you shall return. At this point, the man decides his Isha gets a name, Chava. Right? Chava, because she is the mother of all living. Chai. And Yahuwah, at this point, Elohim, he makes for Adam and for his wife, for Ha-Adam and for Isha, garments of skins, coats of skins, and he clothed them. And now at this point, Yahuwah says, behold, the man has become kind of like one of us. He understands, he yadas, good and evil, tovara. And now, lest he put forth his hand and get that other tree, tree of life, and eat and live forever, going to send him out. He gets shalacht. Divorced. No, it's not divorce, folks. Shalach means to send out. But this is the very same word that is used when a man sends out a wife, hopefully for cause from his house. Adam and his wife are being sent out. They're being shalacht. They're being exiled for cause. And, of course, we find that later on, Adam, well, his descendants, the two wives, northern and southern kingdoms, Israel and Judah, they too get shellacked. Here is the first exile in Scripture, certainly not at all the last. He gets sent forth out of Gan Edan to till the ground from which he was taken. So the first exile is also in this chapter. You see why I say chapter 3? So much important, literally crucial stuff in chapter 3, which sets the, dare I say it, groundwork for everything that is to follow in Scripture. And one of the lines that I like to use, and I'll probably use it at least a few times in the next, the next teaching having to do with this same stuff, is that it's important enough that if it wasn't for chapter 3, the whole rest of the book wouldn't have to have happened. I mean, think about it, right? Here in one chapter, chapter 3 of Genesis, we're seeing, yeah, he knew the end from the beginning. Everything that follows, literally everything that follows, is about making right this first cataclysmically awful failure of covering. It's all about reconciliation. It's all about making teshuvah. It's all about why he does what he does, when he does it, how he does it. To bring back, ultimately, this breach of faith, this breach of trust, this breach of what Yahuwah created man to be and to do. And it's right here. He gets shellacked out of the garden, Gan Edan. And he takes at the east side of the garden of Edan, he puts cherubim with a flaming sword turning every which way to keep, to guard the way back to the tree of life. And then we see chapter 4. And I'm going to go at this point pretty rapidly, even though there's a whole lot of good stuff, just because, as you know, there is so much good stuff here. The man conceived, well, actually, the man knew, he yada. He knew in an intimate sense. You'll hear it termed, he knew her in the biblical sense. And that's exactly what this word yada means, to know experientially. He knew her carnally, okay. He knew her, he was one flesh with her. They became one flesh. Out of that, she conceived, she bore a man. She says, I have gotten a man, Cain, with the help of Yahuwah. And his name, of course, reflects that understanding. And again, she bore another one, his brother Abel. Abel was a keeper of sheep. Cain was a tiller of that ground that's bringing forth other stuff besides herbs, also thorns and thistles. In the process of time, it came to pass, Cain brought his offering. It was of the fruit of the ground to Yahuwah. So did Abel. He brought the firstlings of his flock and the fat thereof. Now, we don't necessarily see a why in this one, but what we know is for some reason it says Yahuwah respected Abel and his offering, but to Cain and to his offering he did not have respect. And that upset old Cain. He was really upset. He was wroth. Wroth mayod, and his countenance fell. And in this line, we're going to get verse 6 and 7, almost an exact repeat of the same comment that is made to the woman about one chapter earlier. And here's another one of those things that if we had more time, I would spend a lot more time talking about. Why are you upset? What's wrong with your countenance? Why has it fallen? If you do well, shall it not be lifted up? And if you do not do well, it says here, sin crouches at the door, and its teshuka, there's that word again, its desire is unto you, but you may have dominion, you may rule over it. Did you catch the reference? The curse of Chava. Your desire will be for your husband. He shall rule over you is almost word for word the same warning that is given here to Cain. He's talking, though, about sin, which crouches at the door. Its desire, its teshuka, is for you, but you had better rule over it, have dominion over it. Well, this seems to have gone over Cain's head. He spoke to his brother Abel. Came to pass when they were out in the field. Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. And Yahuwah now says to Cain, where does he know? Yeah, same kind of concept. Matter of fact, I'm going to contend it's a very similar follow-on. First man, first big mistake. His son, his seed, second big mistake. Where's Abel? I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Well, what have you done? He says, the voice of your brother's blood literally cries out to me from the ground. From Ha Adama tries Dam. His blood, Dam. Can we see the amazing, well, not amazing, it's, I would say, fundamental similarity to these words and right there in the Hebrew. Dam, blood, is part of Ha Adam, who was created from Ha Adama. But that blood, wherein we later learn that's where the life is, it's crying out to him from the ground that, yeah, it returned to. And now it says, now wait a minute, Adam wasn't cursed. The ground was cursed for his sake. Abel's blood is back in the ground. It cries out to Elohim. Who gets cursed? Cain does. You, he says, are now cursed from Ha Adama, from the ground, which has opened up her mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it's not going to be able, it's not going to from this time forward yield its strength to you. You're going to be a fugitive and a wanderer upon Be'eretz in the earth. Cain says to Yahuwah, my punishment is greater than I can handle. All right, look here. You have driven me out this day from the face of the land. From your face will I be hidden. I'll be a fugitive and a wanderer in the earth, and it'll come to pass. Whoever finds me will want to kill me. They'll slay me. Well, wait a minute. Okay, turn around, fair play. Says Yahuwah. All right, therefore, whosoever slays Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. He put a sign, right? You've heard of the mark of Cain, lest anyone finding him should smite him. Cain went out. He dwelt in the land of Nod, east of Edan. He knew his wife. We're going to get and I'll go quickly through this. We're going to get a summary of the offspring of Cain, that line. Okay? His wife conceives. She bears Enoch, not the same one that we're going to hear about later. He builds a city. That name was named after the name of his son Enoch. And unto him, Enoch, was born Irad, who begot Mehuyael, and then in turn Methushael, and then a fellow named Lamech, who has two wives, one Adah, other Zillah. And the first one, Adah, bears a fellow named Yabal, the father of people who dwell in tents and have cattle. So we're seeing out of Cain come a whole line of basically merchants and tradesmen and people that have various skills. Interesting. Brother's name was Yubal. He was father of people that handled harps and pipes. And we have Zillah, who bore Tubal-Cain, the forger of all kinds of instruments, brass and iron. So we got some people that are pretty industrious that come out of Cain. Sister of Tubal-Cain, Naamah. Now, Lamech says to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. I have slain a man for wounding me and a young man for bruising me. If Lamech If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. Now, as you might suspect, this is a little bit ambiguous, and there is a whole lot of midrash on this, oral tradition claims. What is he talking about here? Who is the man? Some will suggest, oh, maybe he's talking about Cain. And the claim is, well, Cain was kind of funny looking. Maybe here's old Lamech out hunting, and he doesn't recognize what's going on. He kills Cain by accident. I don't know. But I've certainly seen lots and lots of stuff. If you read the Midrash, if you look in the commentaries, you'll see all kinds of speculation about this. But back to Adam. He again knows his wife. She bears another son, Set. For Elohim appointed me another seed in the place of Abel, because Cain slew him. Now Seth too has a son. His name is Enosh. And it says, then began men to call upon Beshem on the name of Yahuwah. Chapter 5 is going to give us a whole lot of begatting going on. And I won't read it all, but it's kind of fascinating. What I will suggest, among other things that you get out of this, is, well, the names are almost certainly significant. In each case, we're told that here is a man, and he has a son, male and female. He creates them. He called their name Adam, their name, plural, in the day they were created. And it tells us, for example, number one, Adam lives 130 years. He begot a son. That one was Seth. And after he begot Seth, he lived another 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. So it's not just Seth, but that's the line we're going to get a timeline of. And in total, Adam lived 930 years. Then he died. All right, in each case, Seth, who begets Enosh, we find out how old he is when he begot Enosh and how long he lived after that. And in each case, now we've got a father and a son and a time at the age of their birth of their son that is in the main line, and also how old they were when they died. You can put all this together, and I've done it, and I would encourage folks, if you've never done it, sit down and do it. It's educational, and it kind of helps to make the point. You can actually draw a complete timeline and see whose life overlaps whose, and it's kind of fascinating. You'll see these people knew their great-great-great-great-grandsons. And when you get down to the descendants of Noah, you can actually see that, hey, there were some folks who, were still hanging around. Some of his sons at the time of Abraham and so forth. So it helps to put all of these things together. Basically, one of the things you get out of this chapter is that it's around 2,000 years total, 2 days almost, if you want to look at it that way, 1,000 years being equivalent to or kind of like a day, that we get to the time of the flood. So we can get at least a reasonable indication from the time of creation and the Garden of Eden until the end of the Torah portion here, which is where we're going to go next. We have another fellow down the line. Let's pick it up at about verse 26, chapter 5 of Bereshit. We have this fellow. You've heard of him. Methuselah lived 900 years. Okay, the longest life recorded in Scripture and indeed in human history. This fellow Methuselah. He lived 807 years. He begot his son, whose name is Lamech. Lamech is going to have a son whose name is Noah. So Methuselah is Noah's granddaddy. Tells us that when Methuselah lived, after he had begotten Lamech, he lived until he was 969 years old. 969 years. Again, that's the record holder. Guinness Book of World Records. No, the Scriptural Book of World Records. And then we get to Lamech. He, at age 182, has a son. He called his name Noah. Noach. And it has to do with the root word there being comfort. Because this fella will comfort us in our work and in the toil of our hands, which come from the ground, which Yahuwah, remember, has cursed. And Lamech, after he begot Noah, lives another 595 years. He has other sons and daughters till he dies at age 777. Cool number. And here we now pick up the life of Noah. At age 500, he begot three sons. Well, probably not all of them simultaneously, but we don't know. But at the time when, assume they were sequential, And I think that's a leap. I'm not going to claim that they were. They could have been triplets. Anyway, first one, Shem, then Ham, then Japheth. And now we're going to see that, I'm going to come back and talk about this next week, because I don't necessarily even like the division here, as you know. Men get really ugly. We have a what looks like a crossbreeding going on. The sons of Elohim, we'll see the term Nephilim show up, and then the sons of the Nephilim. And basically there are going to be these people who take Lechach women of the daughters of men. This does not sit well with Elohim. At this point, he says, okay, you know, 120 years, that seems like that ought to be the upper limit. The Nephilim, says verse 4, were in the earth in those days, and after that also, sons of God came into the daughters of men, bore children to them. These were the mighty men of old, men of renown. And there was wickedness, and there was a whole hell of a lot of it. Every imagination, Elohim saw, of their hearts, of the thoughts of the heart of men, was only evil continually. And, in fact, it was so bad that Elohim had, a desire that he hadn't even ever created man on earth. Grieved him at his heart. And he said, I'm going to blot out the man that I have created, mankind, if you will, from the face of the earth. Man and beast, creeping thing and fowl of the air, it repents me that I have even made them. And that is literally, save for one more verse, where the portion ends. This is one of those things that you'll find that is part of the Midrash as well. The sages kind of hate to end on a downer, a downbeat note. So we have one more verse that says, but here, by the way, people talk about grace, New Testament phenomenon. Noah found grace. First use of the word, chen, in the eyes of Yahuwah. We're going to find out more about Noah and what he does next week. But here we have literally a very involved, very significant, perhaps, you know, the most significant in terms of laying out the entire rest of the book, single Torah portion in the Scripture with lots and lots of absolutely key and absolutely packed with information and indeed subtlety. There's that word again, kind of stuff. So I encourage folks, read this and read this over and over again and pay attention to the details and to the sequence and what it is that follows what. And, we get the example, again, of the people where you can put the literal timeline together. But the same thing, I will contend, is true of Genesis chapter 3 and that story. It's the elements, it's the pieces, it's the details here that lay out the rest of the story.